What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, the front of VPR's building here in Colchester was draped with some type of white cloth. As I walked into our cafe, two of my fellow employees were staring out at it discussing Christo, the artist who hung curtains between two Colorado mountains, who wrapped islands in Miami's Biscayne Bay with pink material, and who created golden pathways through Central Park in New York City. Here in 40th and Allen, where our Colchester studios reside, we've seen Rapunzel's braids hung from the water tower, a giant clothesline of laundry strung across the green, and Humpty Dumpty sitting on a wall. All the work of local artist Anne LaBerge. All eye-popping stuff, wild displays, and amazing achievements. But is it art? Does contemporary art allow us to broaden the definition from the literal paintings of those Renaissance masters or the Dutch artists of the 17th century? Joining us today for this discussion are Kira Bacon, the communications director for the Vermont Arts Council. She's also the curator of the council's gallery and sculpture garden and works on an online series called I Am a Vermont Artist. And Rick Cassini-Cador, an artist and writer for Vermont Art Guide magazine. He's also curator with current exhibits at the Wilson Museum at the Southern Vermont Arts Center in Manchester and the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's cover the basics first. I'll start with you, Kira. How do we define contemporary art?
Well, I'm sure Rick will have a bit of a different perspective on that.
Good.
But as far as I'm concerned, contemporary art is art that's being created now in this time. And it might look very similar to works that were produced hundreds of years ago, or it might include technology that didn't exist a couple of hundred years ago. But from my perspective, it's what people are working on and creating now.
Rick?
I like to think of art as a set of questions that since the beginning of modernism, artists have been redefining both what you can make art out of and also what you can get from art. And so we're now at a time where anytime you're invited to consider something as art, it is becomes art. And what that means is that art is best defined as an experience and an attitude that you bring to considering things in our world.
Has that changed through the decades, this idea of art?
Yes. When modernism unfolded at the beginning of the 20th century, what you saw were artists rejecting all sorts of convention that defined art and also put art in the service of the state or the church. Artists decided to liberate what art could be. And they've spent the last century doing just that. But what they haven't done, and what we haven't done very well, is bring the rest of the public along with what we're doing. And so I think a lot of folks feel that art is weird. They're alienated from it. They don't understand what's going on. And there's some shame and attitude sometimes that comes with that. That makes it a little difficult for art to function in society.
Well, on that topic, let's talk to Cody from Verscher, who has a great question. Cody, thanks for joining us today. What's your question for us?
Well, it's more of a comment. I'm an artist. I live in Verscher. Art has tremendous emotional and psychological power. Yet we have given, as a civilization, the lack of credence to objective, beautiful, idealistic art. And it is an insult. The human intelligence and the human soul. And splatter paint cannot be put on the same pedestal, no pun intended, as Michelangelo's Pieta. Deep down, humans know the difference, and our current lack of purpose can be traced to our lack of idealistic art, which can inspire and heal a broken society. The mass shootings will mitigate with an increased objective reality and beauty. And we have to stop pretending that modern art, quote-unquote, there is exceptional modern art out there. But the majority of it, you know, has distortive qualities, you know.
Okay, Cody, great point. Now, let me get a reaction from both Kira and Rick. Go ahead, Kira.
Well, one of the things that I think is wonderful about art is that everyone can feel and think differently about it. And Cody certainly feels that art that was created a century or three, four centuries ago has more merit than things are that are created today. I disagree with that. I think that there's some really powerful art that actually really speaks to the challenges that we have today. And I think it's really important that we look at the whole range of art.
Rick, how do you respond to Cody's thoughts?
Well, it's familiar, and it's something I have been trying to address in my own writing and my own curatorial work for a long time. American art has a very unique history compared to many other countries on the planet, that in the early 20th century, artists realized in America that they didn't really have an art of their own. They were aping what was going on in Britain or France, and they decided to start building that kind of idea of what American art would be. And what they landed on was a style of American scene painting, and that was expressed as regionalism in the countryside and social realism in the more urban areas. But since that time, we've seen art be used for a number of people's agendas. A great example of this is in 1942, when Roosevelt really employed the artist community to get Americans on board with a more internationalist perspective. And in doing that, what they said was art was going to serve both kind of the needs of the government and also the needs of the people. And so they really advocated for German art, Russian art, British art, all being kind of American art. After 1942, what happened was art, the power of art that was in Europe was ultimately concentrated in New York. Mm. And along the same time, we had the start of the Cold War. And that's when the CIA said, we need to kind of put art in the service of the Cold War. So what it did is it said, we're going to promote and privilege the avant-garde, the most cutting-edge art that is possibly being made at any one time, and say this is American art. And we're going to do that to show the rest of the world that we are a free zone of thinking and we are this open-minded. And since that time, we have largely been privileging the avant-garde. But the problem is that avant-garde art is kind of like listening to two neuroscientists at a dinner table. At some point, unless you're a neuroscientist, you just sit there politely and say, this conversation isn't about me. And as such, the American public, I think, has been largely alienated from what we've been doing in the art world all of these years.
Well, how much do we have to understand art, Kira, to appreciate art?
That's a really good question. And my view of that is that it's really important that people feel they have permission to experience art in whatever way makes sense to them. So you might look at, as Cody said, something that's splatter painting and say, I don't get this. My five-year-old could do this. But someone else might look at that and see a color or a pattern or a shape that really makes sense to them. And so my message to people is always, you know, give yourself permission to experience art at whatever level you want to and to see what it makes you feel.
How wide, how broadly can we cast the contemporary art net? Painting, sculpture, film, music, dance, architecture, beyond. Where's the limits of what is contemporary art, Kira?
I would say that it can be many, many things, from what people are doing in graphic design, what people are doing with digital games, for instance, to architecture, art, dance, literary arts. I think it covers the gamut.
Rick, a lot of people are intimidated by art. So how do they get past that? You know art. I don't know art. How do I appreciate, understand, get, love art?
Well, I'll tell you, there are two. As someone who spends all day, every day, thinking and viewing art, there are two of my favorite things to do when I go to a gallery museum. When I go to a museum, I like to go to the Renaissance room, and I like to look for all of the ugly babies in the Renaissance paintings. And when I go to galleries, one of my favorite things to do is to find out which work I hate the most. And I don't do that because I'm cynical or jaded. I do that because when I find that work that is just upsetting me the most, that's often the one I want to learn the most about, where there are more interesting stories. And for me, art is often about the stories around it. And so I keep looking for those stories, and I ask other people what those stories are. So in terms of, you know, folks feeling intimidated, or someone once told me they didn't feel smart enough for art, you know, I think that throw that out the door. You know, the reality is that one has no need to feel intimidated. And if someone is throwing you attitude, that's more on them than anyone else. And you don't have to be educated to enjoy art. You just need to go and engage with it.
I'm going to take it one step further. In 1993, Morley Safer did a piece on 60 Minutes that seemed to articulate what was going on in contemporary art, or at least how many in the public perceived it. We're going to listen to a quick clip from that show. First, you'll hear some art critics, then from Safer himself, and then some reactions to some contemporary pieces and art selling at Sotheby's auction for over six digits.
It's a standard assumption in the art world today that a work of art is anything an artist says it is. And an artist is somebody who calls himself an artist, and there are no other tests.
When I look at almost all contemporary art, I see nothing. Nothing.
Of course, most of this art of the 90s would be worthless junk without the hype of the dealers and, even more important, the approval of the critics.
It's very much about something extremely banal made into something terrifically heroic and important.
I don't understand it one scrap. I don't understand it at all.
Well, we don't belong to this generation. We must retire.
That piece included a couple of vacuum cleaners in plexiglass. So, Rick, when did art jump the shark to the point where installing urinals in an art gallery was art?
Again, we're talking about, and what Morley Safer was doing in that piece is something we've done with art pretty routinely, which is to point to the most controversial, the most expensive, or the most outrageous piece of art and say, this is art. All art is like this. And here's the thing. What that does is that alienates the public from art. Most people only learn about art when it is profoundly stupid, utterly controversial, or incredibly expensive. All three things that alienate people like Cody from going out and seeing art. Now, the reality in Vermont in particular is that artists are making all sorts of work and trying to find all sorts of ways of reaching an audience. But It is, I think, very intentional tool to characterize art in those very reductionistic ways and ultimately separate people from art.
Kira, has contemporary art moved past that, and how, if it has?
Well, I think that, as Rick said, there are still these moments. We just heard of something about weeks ago about a piece that was sold for hundreds of millions of dollars, the most expensive. But we're in Vermont, and I think one of the things that is wonderful about Vermont is that the experience of the arts and artists is very, very tied to our communities. We don't have a big art center. We don't put our art, for the most part, in sterile white boxes. It is of the land. It's of the people. And so I think in Vermont, we don't have to deal with a lot of those issues. I'm sure there are a lot of artists in Vermont that would like their works to be sold for higher prices. But I think that Vermont is not in that mode.
What is the actual power of art? Give me specific examples of how it can affect a community or start dialogue, meaningful dialogue.
Well, I can talk about an experience I had very recently of a choreographer, Hannah Dennison, is working on a piece that she is doing in a quarry in Vermont. And so you have these huge sheer granite walls in this quarry that are so spectacular, and this beautiful water. And Hannah is working with dancers on floating platforms to create a dance piece. And what she's doing is she's bringing together the history of granite in Vermont, the beautiful landscape and materials that make up Vermont, and also very, very contemporary ideas for dance. And to me, that is such a great melding of the old and the new.
Rick, where do you see it being powerful and in action?
Well, I'll talk about a work that is in the show at the Wilson Museum at the Southern Vermont Arts Center. It's by Colchester artist Carol McDonald, and it is six orbs, large orbs, all in various tones. And Carol is really speaking about the different seasons in Vermont. I love this piece because it helped me work out something that I was really struggling with. I hate winter. I find it long and oppressive, and it just makes me sad and feels like it goes on and on forever. But Carol's rendition of the seasons of Vermont were not the four seasons of Vermont. They were the six seasons of Vermont. That in addition to the four we know, she included stick season and mud season and tried to convey a sense of experience about that. And when I saw that piece, I had the realization, oh, I don't hate winter. I hate mud season and stick season. The winter's actually really nice. And that's how art can operate. It can completely change how we approach a problem or think of something.
So, Rick, you're now a winter guy.
I when it's sunny and crisp white snow covering everything, yeah, I'm down.
Kira, what steps can people take toward being more open to appreciating art that might seem challenging or confusing to them?
I think that it's to a certain extent the responsibility of those of us that are curators and arts professionals, gallery owners, museum people, to be very open and welcoming to people. I think it's important to have art in places that everyone goes to buy their morning coffee or to go to a park with their children. And so I think that if we just give people a little window into looking at something, an idea that, and Rick was just talking about Carol McDonald's paintings, that just little tiny window that he got into understanding, oh, stick season, mud season, gave him a completely different experience of that work and also of his own reflective experience.
I'm Rick Zingari, and this is Vermont Edition. Last year at this time, a friend visited an exhibit called Backstory at Kent's Corner in Calais. Afterwards, she implored me to go. This annual art exhibit only lasts for a month, and I put off going until the final weekend. What I found was stunning. Room after room brought new and varied delights. The art was provocative and stunning. On one landing, there was a rewired cigarette machine that dispensed tiny pieces of art created by the exhibit's artists for $10. This year, the exhibit is called Revision, and it runs through October 6th, and it's a great example of how we can easily access contemporary art in our communities. Today, this is our topic of discussion. Here to talk about contemporary art with us are Kira Bacon of the Vermont Arts Council and Rick Cassini-Cador, a writer, artist, and curator with exhibits at the Southern Vermont Arts Center in Manchester and the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg. We did hear from Corinne, who emailed, "I'm a Vermont artist living and working in Burlington. My primary income is from my community-based art projects where I create collaborative, participatory art pieces. I went to UVM, I came from a low-income family, and experienced a lot of pressure to study something that would be, quote, useful. But art was always my passion. I've grappled with the desire to create magnificent, powerful art pieces with my own identity as a low-income person. Art is not accessible to me as a career, and art is not accessible to the community from which I came. I found that when I host drop-in art sessions to chronically homeless folks, or when I bring my recorder to a memory care facility, people are able to fully realize their own voice and their own strengths of character." Kira, let's talk about artists now. What do they want from their audience? What do artists you work with want from an audience from a gallery showing?
I think that what artists want from their audiences is as different as every artist is. I think some artists have a very strong intellectual perspective on their art, and they want people to understand it on that level. I think a lot of artists are happy to have people experience the art at the level they want to. And I think just to build on what you said about the exhibit at the Kent Museum, I think that's the perfect example of how Vermont brings together this wonderful historic structure that luckily has been retained and contemporary art. And that juxtaposition is just extraordinary. And there are many places in Vermont where you can see that combination of history and of contemporary sculpture. And the other thing that occurs to me is at this time of year when the leaves are turning, what a great time to get out and see art outdoors. And there's so much wonderful sculpture in Vermont.
Rick, artists have got to eat. So how does an artist balance self-expression with creating something that sells?
I think that's one of the challenges a lot of artists, particularly Vermont artists, are facing today. But we also have to understand that the business of art or the career of art has changed a lot. There are some artists who are making work specifically to sell, meaning I'm going to make a picture and I'm going to try to sell it to my neighbor. There are other artists who are engaged in large-scale, complicated projects. And to fund those projects, they are writing grants, getting awards, soliciting from donors to kind of build and produce those projects. The kind of product for sale model is not a model that speaks to all artists working these days.
Yeah. All right. It's time for us to hear from some of our listeners. Let's go first to Montpelier and talk to Margaret. Hi, Margaret. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. What I've been hearing has been these sort of two conversations, or several conversations, actually, about different kinds of art. And one of the kinds of art is an art that's more developmental, where it follows a path or a trajectory. And the artists have faith in the art as a discipline, and they see destinations that can be reached. And you sort of know what you get. It can be measured. And then what I've been hearing is another kind of art that's more of an experiment where you don't know what it is, and the artists don't have a concrete answer or a direction. And so I work at the T.W. Wood Gallery, where we show historic collections, and we have a contemporary gallery. And my question is, I wanted to see if you think that there's a relationship between these two different kinds of art, the developmental art that follows a trajectory, maybe even regionalism, and then this experimental nature of art with no determined outcome.
Great, Margaret. Let's hear from Rick. What do you think, Rick?
Well, Margaret, that was kind of the premise of the show we have open at the Wilson Museum at the Southern Vermont Art Center, where we looked at the early Southern Vermont artists who were largely regionalist painters. And we tried to make connections between this landscape or this portrayal of the land with what contemporary artists were doing. And what we found is that there are a lot of connections to be had, that artists 80, 100 years ago were trying to tell stories about their neighbors and tell stories for their neighbors. And that's not unlike what artists, particularly artists in Vermont, are trying to do today. The challenge is for us to find ways of telling those stories and getting people interested in hearing them.
At that exhibit, you have an artist who was at the Kent last year, Wendy Kopp. Describe to people her work, because I walked into a room with Wendy Kopp art and I was stunned.
So Wendy Kopp is interested in telling a story to us about invasive species, and particularly this one called Phlamites, which is what you see kind of growing on 89 in the medium. It grows in wetlands, and it's invasive, and it chokes out wetlands, and it prevents other species from or native species from taking root. And to tell us this story, what Wendy does is harvest these weeds, these invasive species, and then weaves them into outfits that look like a combination of pioneer woman or apocalyptic future man, and presents them in the gallery and asks us to consider them. And this is the thing, is that you can take these really seriously about this intense conversation about our environment and invasive species, or you can also see this as just really kind of fun and funny that this weed that is a problem is being made into outfits that we can then go look at and say, that's a cool, interesting outfit. What's going on here? And then learn about it.
Let's take another call from Dennis in New Haven. Go right ahead, Dennis.
Hey, your program is very, very good. All your comments are excellent, including that first caller. I'd like to address the economics of doing art. I built the Leapfrog sculpture in Church Street and the cat for UVM and Thomas Jefferson down Southways. And I basically have made my living out of state. And those things just kind of happened because I love Vermont. I came in 1970. But what I'm comparing the arts to now is the global warming. I've taken six cross-country trips and found that the arts are in trouble. The people are going out of business, foundries are quitting, and the economics of art is getting so skimpy that not a lot of great things can be done. And I'm interested in the next generations of picking up the story of who we are and all of the stuff that our ancestors made that was so spectacular in so many museums. And they didn't have to have the decoration of a lion on the hilt of a sword or anything like that. It was all about this passion with nature like Leonardo da Vinci had. So,
well, Dennis, let me hop in here for just a moment. I want to read a comment that we got from Donna. She says, I'm an artist in the Northeast Kingdom and come from an art family. I've been wondering about traditional art versus more abstract or conceptual art. Many people can only seem to relate to things that are inherently understand, like realism or impressionistic realism. I also recognize that those with the income to purchase contemporary art do not purchase these works, investments, in Vermont. Therefore, I believe that it is very important to get our Vermont works out of state. So both are asking, in a way, is there a market? Can people sell their art here in Vermont? Rick?
Well, a couple thoughts on that. For one, when I researched the Southern Vermont artists, what I found was that they also complained and struggled with the market in Vermont. But this funding of the arts and the market, I believe, is a symptom of this larger problem around how the arts are alienated from the American public. What you find is those artists who are making work that speak to an audience have developed a market from that audience, and they're able to do that work. The challenge is one which is looking at how the arts play out in our broader socioeconomic system. And just to build on that a little bit, that we often like to think that the end-all solution is we just need more government funding. In the arts, that's an often reoccurring theme. Yes, there is a need for more funding. However, there's also a need for greater strategy, and particularly about how we value the arts and what we do with it. And a great example is our neighbors to the north in Quebec. There's a program in Quebec that helps artists export their work beyond the borders of Quebec to ship it to Europe, to the Americas, as a way of promoting the arts. That is a very rare program in all of the United States to have that kind of exportation type program. But it's one of those pieces of critical infrastructure that artists need in order to kind of build a career and make a living. And one more thing on that point, which is we have an untapped resource in Vermont. They are often have master's degrees. They're incredibly talented. They're knowledgeable. And they're making below poverty wages, providing a service to our community. That this is an asset that we should be building and tapping into. Vermont has some serious challenges with depopulation and an aging population coming up. Artists can play a role in that. And artists can activate vacant space. And artists can make things with recycling that we cannot get rid of otherwise.
Well, Kira, I know Vermont Arts Council. As a representative of the Arts Council, you have met 95%, 99% of these artists that Rick is talking about here in Vermont. So how do you work with them? What do you do to make sure that they can survive here in Vermont?
Well, I wish that I could say that we can help them survive in Vermont. It's a much bigger issue. But we have a program that's very specifically dedicated to providing individual artists a grant to create new work. It's a small grant. It's $4,000. It's not going to change their lives. But what we hope, it can just give them a little bit of space, a little cushion, a little support so that they can do important work. And interestingly, in the last several years, three people who have gotten creation grants, as they're called, have published works based that they started on that program and have to great critical acclaim. So I think that that's something that we try to do to give artists that little extra boost.
There is a program you work with on the Arts Council called I Am a Vermont Artist. Tell us about what you do there.
This is a project that's very near and dear to my heart, and it came out of last autumn when there was so many negative things about race and hatred in our country and a bunch of a bunch of cultural leaders throughout the state came together and said, we need to start working on what we can do to turn the page on this era. And they are working very hard on that, looking at what can we do right now? How can we take a tiny step? We decided to focus a series of interviews in our e-newsletter on artists that have experiences that are not of the 95% in Vermont. So whether it's ethnic, racial, country of origin, gender identity, disability. And so we seek out artists and highlight them every 2 weeks. And one of the things that I have found extraordinary is that all these artists are so different, but when they talk about their experience of being a Vermont artist, there's so many similarities in the way that they respond to winter, to the landscape, and it feels like there's more that brings us together than tears us apart.
We've talked a lot about engaging with art. Now the question is, how do we buy art? How do we know it's worth it? How do we get started? Rick, I'm going to start with you.
I'm a big believer that if you I'll tell you about my brother-in-law.
All right.
My sister married a really nice guy, really good guy from Vermont, very much a Vermonter guy, works in a bread factory in Rutland. And before he married my sister, knew nothing about art. And because of my sister and I would often hang out at openings or doing art in the park in Rutland or socializing around the arts, he would come along. And at first he really didn't kind of know what was going on, was a little intimidated by it. But over time, by just kind of engaging it, he's found pieces he likes. He's arranged to buy them. You know, his taste is different than mine, but it's not nearly as conservative as I thought it would be when I first met him. And sometimes he likes the color, and sometimes he likes the shape, and sometimes he just likes the artist who he spent an hour talking to at their booth. And the thing is, that's what you do. You know, you go out and you find art, and you see something you like. And what's great about Vermont is you can go to an event like Art Hop we had last weekend, spend $50 or spend $500. You can go to Art in the Park and find something for $100 or $1,000. That Vermont is a wonderful place to shop for art because it's really catering to everyone who lives here.
Kira, I'm going to give you the last question. Vermonters, how can we support the arts community? What can we do as an everyday person to support those artists that we've talked about all day now?
That's a great question, Rick. And I think that as the other Rick was saying, you know, get out and enjoy the arts. Go to art openings. Go to art shows. Attend performances. Show your support by showing up and being there.
I think of going to the farmer's market. I like to talk to the person who raises my radishes and my tomatoes. There's also artists at the farmer's market. Doug Knapp comes to mind, is very quirky art, and many others. And you can talk directly to them, learn about what they do, and support them that way. Kira Bacon is Communications Director for the Vermont Arts Council, curator for the Council's Gallery and Sculpture Garden. Thanks for joining us, Kira.
Thank you.
And Rick Cassini-Cador is a writer for Vermont Art Guide magazine and curator with current exhibits at the Southern Vermont Arts Center in Manchester and the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.